Everest is definitely up there as one of the hardest things that I've done. It's a slog, and anyone that thinks that it's easy, because a lot of people climb it, is disillusioned. You know, anyone that asks me, is Everest hard? I say it's going to be the hardest thing that you ever do in your life.
Right.
It's just, you're sleep deprived, living at altitude, eating the same food over and over again for 6 weeks, living in a tent, you know, away from the luxuries of showering and sticking on your aftershave and waxing your hair. Sorry, Alex.
Sorry. Yeah.
But yeah, it's definitely, you know, even the mental monotony of, you know, whether you're going to summit or not, and doing it the first time, it's easier because there's no pressure. Doing it the second time, it's harder because you've already summited, and you know, you waste six or 7 weeks of your life to summit this mountain and stand on this hill, and if you don't do it, it's a, you know, it's definitely a big failure.
Everyone has ambitions. To start their own business, to lose weight, to launch a podcast. But for most of us, those ambitions are still on the to-do list. We'll get round to them one day. But some people overcome procrastination. That thing you'd love to do? They knew the risks, but said screw it and just did it anyway. On the Screw It, Just Do It podcast, I'm on a mission to answer one simple question. How do you get to where you want to be? Joining me are inspirational entrepreneurs, sports stars, entertainers, and authors who took the leap. They became the people they wanted to be. They did what they always wanted to do. In this series of revealing, challenging, and often surprising conversations, they might just help you discover how to do it too.
Welcome to another episode of Screw It, Just Do It with me, Alex, and my very special guest today, Jay Morton, former SAS operator, soldier, book author, two-time Everest summiteer, who was also part of the directing staff on Channel 4's SAS Who Dares Wins, adventurer and explorer. I like that. I wish I had that at the end of mine there. Adventure and explorer. Jay spent 14 years of distinguished military service, 10 years within the SAS and 4 within the parachute regiment. Did 4 tours of Afghanistan, 3 of Iraq, and 2 of covert operational deployments. He's a keen trail runner, cyclist, climber, surfer, skier, and cold water dipper. He's also a podcast host and a Praga car racing driver. Miss anything out?
Probably, yeah.
We can probably get to that.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
So I always start by asking, any screw it, just do it moments in your life that stopped you from procrastinating and took you from the path you were on to a different trajectory in life? And I'm interested to start by exploring how you firstly went from the military to forging a new career for yourself. And then later, I'd like to find out a little bit more about where you're at now in 2023 and about to embark on what sounds like a very exciting year. But first off, let's start with finishing the military and forging a new career for yourself. Were there any screw it, just do it moments there?
Yeah, probably loads. And I think thinking throughout my whole life, there was probably a load of screw it, just do it moments. You know, that being in the special forces and being in the military, it's a high octane, fast paced life. You spend a lot of your time away training or on operations. And when I joined, I went into mountain troop, and that's my insurgent skill that I specialized in. And throughout my time in mountain troop, I just found a love and affinity for being in the mountains. Climbing was something that I'd never done before. Coming from Preston, there's not much climbing and not much to do in the outdoors. So being exposed to climbing and skiing and the outdoors through the special forces, kind of found a love and found an affinity for it. And I was lucky enough to go away and train in the Alps for 2 years to become a mountain guide. And I do think that during my time out in the Alps and being exposed to, you know, the beauty of the mountains and the freedom and something that wasn't military and something that wasn't, you know, specific to military training, which is all I'd pretty much done since I was 19 to that point, that was like a big eye opener for me.
Mm-hmm.
And probably the moment where I said to myself, you know, there's more out there in life than just being in the special forces and chasing a career in the special forces. And I do think, you know, coming back from that, there was definitely a screw it, just do it moment of just, you know, I'm 30 years old at the time. And I was like, and I remember being, you know, it was me and a guy called Joe, and we had this ski tour off the back of a place called the Fellhorn, and we used to do it all the time. And it was a bit of a secret spot. We used to call it Mini Chamonix. And we're sat on this, you ski tour up. It's about 2.5-3 hours to get to the top of this Mini Chamonix. And I remember just being, you know, stood there having a sandwich and like a cup of tea, and just thinking like there's so much more to do out there. There's so much more to see. There's so much more experiences and opportunity out there. And, you know, that was the switch pretty much in my head, that I need to start putting myself in positions now that are going to lead to different opportunities, or speak to different people, or go to things that I wouldn't necessarily go to or go for, and almost put my kind of net out there and see what's there.
And what were some of those actions that you then took to do that, out of interest? What kind of examples?
So when I came back from that, I got the opportunity to do Everest. So again, being in the mountains, that kind of led to doing a mountain like Everest. And I guess that's the biggest one. That's a no-brainer when I got asked to do that. And originally it was to climb K2. And that obviously then led to, you know, what I'm doing this year. But I think naturally making the decision in your head that you want to change your path.
Yeah.
You instantly just see things in a different way. Mm-hmm. Whereas if I was in the special forces and I was so focused on, you know, my next posting, being a TL, being a sergeant major, you know, where I was going to go in my career, what operations I was going to do. Now it's like the way I was thinking and the opportunities that I was looking for was completely different to that. It was, you know, the conversations that I was having with people were different. You know, the media or whatever it was, the podcast that I was listening to, everything was geared around, you know, that moment on Little Chamonix where I was like, right, how can I have more of these moments?
Yeah. I'm going to Chamonix on Friday. Nice. I looked at the weather last night and it was snowing. I looked this morning, it's still snowing.
Yeah. I've got some friends skiing at the minute. It's just, it's
end
dumping.
Of March.
Yeah, I know.
It's like insane, isn't it?
Yeah.
And to ask you as well, like, as I understand it, like from your book, from your bio, you'd always wanted to join the military as a kid growing up in Preston. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Originally wanted to join the Royal Marines.
Okay.
And again, it was, you know, if you were to say, why did I want to join the military? I have no idea. I feel like sometimes you just get drawn to do things. Mm. And at the time, you know, 18, 19 years old, I couldn't hand on heart say it was for these reasons. It was just like, that looks awesome. I want to go and do it. And, you know, I could go back and say that as a child, or, you know, growing up in school, being indoors and being in classrooms just, you know, didn't make me feel good. Mm. I preferred to be outside. I'm, you know, quite lucky to be a kid that grew up when social media and mobile phones wasn't a thing. So
definitely
you spent most of your time outside covered in mud, you know, trying to smash windows or do stuff that every adolescent teenager tries to do. Drunk a lot of cider. And yeah, you know, if I could go back and do something different for school, I definitely would. But I wanted to join the Royal Marines and went into the careers office, and some big sergeant major was sat across from me on the desk and asked me how many pull-ups I could do. And I don't think I could do a pull-up at that stage. So
right.
Said you need to do, I think it was 15 or 12 to join the Royal Marines. So I walked straight out of there and walked into the Army careers office and joined the paras.
How many pull-ups to get in the paras?
I don't even think they asked if I could do pull-ups. It was more, yeah. But I mean, equally, you know, Royal Marines and the paras are both equally the best, you know, units in the British Army.
And again, I read, you know, that you had a relatively short attention span at school, always kind of getting yourself into trouble. How did it go from being like that to entering an environment that, having not been in it, but I'd imagine is a pretty disciplined organization in which you're required to be pretty focused at times? Mm. What's that contrast was like initially for you?
Yeah, I think, you know, going back to being a kid and not having a good attention span and getting into trouble quite a lot, you know, I probably didn't enjoy what I was doing. Probably didn't enjoy going to school. Found outlet in playing rugby and smashing windows and drinking cider, which, you know, most people growing up when I did exactly the same. So going into the military and knowing that, you know, you're part of a team and people rely on you and you rely on them, that's important. I think also, you know, putting yourself through stressful situations with other people is, you know, how you build mass amounts of resilience for any level of stress. Mm. I think equally doing it with other people bonds you as a team and brings you closer to other people. And I definitely forged some of the greatest friendships of my life within the military. And the majority of those were forged, you know, in operations doing, you know, dangerous tasks and missions.
Yeah. And a lot of those people still in the military that you made those friendships with, or have most of them come out?
The majority of them, it's hard to say. A lot of them I don't speak to anymore. Like a lot of the guys that I joined the paras with, I don't speak to, and that's just a testament of time.
Yeah.
But, you know, if I saw the face again walking down a street or in a pub, it's like, you know, it's like you've never not seen them. It's like your best friends again. A lot of guys that went on to join the SAS, I still keep in touch with. And then there's a select number of guys in the Special Forces that I still keep in touch with. Mm-hmm. It's a weird place, you know. The Special Forces is a very, very busy world. And, you know, as soon as you jump out of it, you're irrelevant in that world. Mm-hmm. Everyone's so focused on what they're doing, and it's a big rat wheel. So,
yeah. Yeah.
You've just got to accept that.
And how, conversely, did you manage to cope with, say, leaving the military and forging a different path in life that you'd done? Was that an easy transition, or it seems a lot of people that I've known, when they come out of that, there's an initial struggle. Mm. Were you similar, or did you just keep yourself busy like you are at the moment?
Yeah, I think, I never really found like I struggled much. And when I kind of think back to that, I'd probably put it down to a few things. Probably knowing what I was going to go and do, like having a plan.
And that was Everest at the time?
Yeah, well, it was going and working with Through Dark, the clothing brand.
Yeah.
So that was the initial kind of work that I was going to go out and do. And it was to be an expedition director. So, you know, I was still going to be climbing. I was still going to be going to the mountains. I'm still going to be doing Everest. Still going to be doing expeditions. And, you know, when I say a plan, it's as loose as it comes. It's a plan in my head and not a written down plan. But
right.
I think being able to challenge myself when I got out in a space that I wanted to challenge myself in, and not say go and sit in an office in London, and, you know, that would probably depress me and I'd struggle with that.
Yeah.
And then when I left, I was still surrounded by ex-Special Forces guys, so you still have that kind of I won't call it brotherhood, but there's still that kind of language that you use, and whether it's spoken or unspoken, there's a you know, and you meet someone who's ex-Special Forces, you can sit there and speak for, you know, for hours. There was that, and I'm not gonna lie, there was times where you kind of questioned whether you made the right or wrong decision. But I think, you know, every day gets better, every week gets better. And you know, you soon realize that you're not J Morton ex-special or J Morton SAS soldier, or even J Morton ex-SAS soldier. You're just who you are in that moment.
Yeah. And I know you like a challenge, be that climbing, hiking, running, surfing, skiing, but what's the hardest, most challenging thing you've done to date, like mentally and physically, or one of the two?
Everest is definitely up there as one of the hardest things that I've done. It's a slog. And anyone that thinks that it's easy, because a lot of people climb it, is disillusioned. You know, anyone that asks me, is Everest hard? I say it's going to be the hardest thing that you ever do in your life.
Right.
It's just, you're sleep deprived, living at altitude, eating the same food over and over again for 6 weeks, living in a tent, you know, away from the luxuries of showering and sticking on your aftershave and waxing your hair. Sorry, Alex.
Sorry.
But yeah, it's definitely, you know, even the mental monotony of, you know, whether you're going to summit or not, and doing it the first time, it's easier because there's no pressure. Doing it the second time, it's harder because you've already summited, and, you know, you waste six or 7 weeks of your life to summit this mountain and stand on this hill. And if you don't do it, it's a, you know, it's definitely a big, big failure.
And with that moment that you stand on the hill, how different did it feel the first time to the second time that you did it? Is it a different feeling?
Yeah, completely. The first time, it's weird, you know, it's a bit anticlimactic.
Right.
You're constantly looking up at these hills and these mountains. When you finally stand on it, and the first time, you know, I'm stood on Everest, it's the highest point on this planet. And you're just looking down, and it's a patch of snow. there's nothing like significant about it. And actually, at the time I climbed it, there was no one else on there was no one else on the summit when I got to the top, just because there was a load of storms and some people turned around. So when I got to the top, there was a couple of Korean climbers and they took a picture of me, which turned out to be blurry. And they came off the hill and I was just stood up on my own on the summit, which, yeah, it's pretty special. And I remember trying to think in my head, like, how do you make the most of this moment?
Yeah.
You know, you do this, I meditate, like I do all this stuff about being in the present moment. And it's like, how do I actually make the most of this? And there's no way you can do that. It's almost just being there is part of it. But I took my iPhone out, started filming a little video, and then that broke in the cold.
Yeah. Oh, Jesus.
But yeah, the second time was different. There was a bigger client base. There was 7 clients that I had to get to the summit. And, you know, of various skill sets and experiences. And I think managing a group of that level is quite difficult. There were guys that I'd told to turn around and that I didn't want to take on the mountain. So trying to manage that when they've paid, you know, 30-40 grand of their own money to climb it. And then there were, you know, some strong cats in there. So yeah, you know, I got on the summit with 3 other guys from that 7 and I actually cried.
Did you?
Yeah. Just like as in a relief, you know? You know, I kind of put my money where my mouth is with that kind of stuff. And I'd always said to the clients, if you stick with me, you'll get to the summit. And yeah, it was, yeah, me and 3 of them got to the summit.
So that first time when it's just you up there, and are you thinking in your head, I am stood on the highest point on planet Earth and I'm the only one stood here, right now.
Yeah. Literally, yeah. That's exactly what I was thinking. I was just like, how weird is it that I'm the highest person in the world? Yeah, no one knows.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Unless that person up in the space station down there is looking down on me.
I know, yeah. It is surreal, but again, it's a random anticlimax. And you get, you know, when you get to the top and you get back down, all you want to do is get off the mountain.
Yeah. But is that not often the way with whatever goal you might set yourself in life, once you've actually achieved it, you go, okay, next one.
Yeah, 100%. And I think, you know, if you've got a growth mindset and you're that way out, you're constantly tipping off all these little goals and like getting better at stuff and you don't really realize it. And you're in, you know, a year later, you're in a better place than you were a year before. And then 5 years later, you're like, wow, I'm like a completely different person. But we don't stop and like appreciate it or go or celebrate it in any way. We're just on to the next thing because we're so like tunnel visioned on what's next. And
that's what I was chatting with Sabrina about before, literally her saying like, she, you know, never takes the time to celebrate the goal because it's already on to the next goal. And also of how different friends are from, you know, 10 years ago when she was, you know, coming out of school and stuff and going, people going, you've changed. And she's like, yeah, you haven't. You know.
Exactly.
Which I totally got.
Yeah, you know. Completely.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode. And pardon the interruption. This is an advertisement for BetterHelp Therapy Online. Getting to know yourself can be a lifelong process, especially because we're always growing and changing. I know the last few years have been a period of reflection and resetting for a lot of people, myself included. As regular listeners will know, I embraced a lot of new things into my life, including cold water therapy and long distance running. Therapy, in whatever form, is all about deepening your self-awareness and understanding. Because sometimes we don't know what we want or why we react the way we do until we talk through things. Personally, the last few years have seen for the very first time me struggling with my mental health. And I've been fortunate enough to be able to talk to people who can help. BetterHelp connects you with a therapist who can take you on that journey of self-discovery from wherever you are. I feel like I've changed a lot in the last few years and I know that I've really grown as a person as I've gotten to know myself better. I've really invested the time to do this and I know I'll never stop learning. So don't be afraid to open up and ask for help. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a therapist and switching therapists anytime for no additional charge. With over 1,000 therapists in the UK already, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Our listeners get 10% off their very first month at betterhelp.com/justdoit. That's betterhelp.com/justdoit. just do it. Now, back to this week's episode.
Tell me a little bit about the guys that you had to tell to turn around and go back then. I mean, who are those trips for? Because I know you got, we'll talk about what you got coming up, but somebody wants, you know, to go on an expedition and you're like, follow me and you'll get there. Mm-hmm. What kind of people does that attract? Or who are you looking for to go with you?
Yeah, probably a wide mix of people, really. You know, our expedition or that expedition was a mix of, you had an explorer on there, you had who'd done kind of polar expeditions, you had an Indian climber that wanted to be the youngest, I think the youngest Indian climber to summit Everest. And you had, there was a friend of mine, Tom, who was ex-SAS, or he was in the SAS at the time, he's now out. And who else? Yeah, another ex-Special Forces guy, an ex-military officer, and a Kenyan guy, Sam, who's a legend. But yeah, so it attracts a massive mix of people. I mean, if you know, there's 1,000 people that attempt to climb Everest every year.
Right.
And they range from people that have a lot of money and it's on their bucket list and they just want to do it. Diehard mountaineers, people that don't earn a lot of money, but they've managed to scrimp and scrave because it's been their absolute goal to climb Everest.
Right.
But I think you've got to have a lot of heart in the game if you want to climb it, because, you know, to save up $30,000 to $50,000 and give 6 weeks of your life to be in excruciating pain to stand on this, you know, bit of snow on top of a hill is, you know, you've really got to want it to get up there.
Mm. And do they have to have some form of training before they get up there?
Again, you know, Nepal's not that well regulated.
Right.
So if you're a Nepalese person or a Westerner, you can register your expedition business and take whoever you want up there.
Okay.
So there are, you know, I'm not trying to diss anyone out there, but there are companies out there that probably don't regulate who they take up as well as other companies do.
Yeah.
If you want to climb with some of the top expedition companies in the world, you know, NIMS's company, Elite Exped, there's a few others, Russell Bryce's company, 14 Peaks, there's a UK company, but any of those big companies, you know, you're obviously going to pay a premium for that, but you know, there's more of a chance of a level of screening before going on, or they'll, you know, like ourselves at Elite, we like to see you climb, you know, a 6,000 meter mountain before you go on an 8,000 meter mountain. We like to see you climb a lower 8,000 mountain like Manaslu before you then go and attempt something like Everest.
Right. Okay.
So that kind of, you know, at the point that you're climbing Everest, you pretty much, you're guaranteeing, you know, yourself getting to the summit unless kind of weather or kind of situations or anything out of that window stops you from getting there.
Mm. I know you enjoy it, testing yourself, and I'm the same, and I'm sure it's a very different thing, something like Everest compared to running a marathon, but, you know, kind of things
running
that...
Running a marathon's hard, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is, it's kind of that thing again that you, and I don't know how much of it is, you know, the mental versus the physical payoff, but for me, it's like doing something hard and getting an intangible, you know, reward from it. Like when I did during lockdown a marathon on my own, literally from where I live to where you live and like back again, and a few laps around Poole Park, because I realized I completely screwed up how long it actually was to get it done. But everyone going, what, you did it on your own? You didn't get a medal for it? And it's like, well, I didn't do it for the medal.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, you must get that you're putting yourself out there, but you're going to experience some form of mental and physical pain depending on what you're going to do. But there's that payoff.
It's sometimes more rewarding doing it on your own.
When no one
knows about it and you just knuckle down and smash a marathon out. Mm. I don't know. It's like it's building those layers on you, isn't it? It's like the more you can just do hard stuff, the more layers you just build on yourself. And, you know, when you're exposed to, you know, actual stress, whether it's, I don't know, job stress or family stress, it's like you feel that stress less because you've gone out there and done the marathon, or you've gone out there and, you know, in the absolute pissing rain, you've gone and got in the sea at 6 o'clock in the morning. And
yeah,
I feel like it just builds armor on your body, you know?
Agrees. Yeah, no, that's really good way to describe it. Yeah, no, I remember, I think he probably says it in his book, David Goggins, like, you know, when you're actually doing something like that, and he calls it like the cookie jar, isn't it, to like reach in there, and there's the cookie. Yeah. You've done it before, you've been somewhere, you can pull like a memory out and go, I can actually do this because I've done that.
100%, it's a confidence.
Mm. Yeah, confidence.
It's like, you know, if you look at the majority of people in the world these days, you know, they're not looking after their body. They're not looking after their health. They're not testing themselves. They're not putting themselves in, you know, stressful situations. so it's like when you almost want to stand out in that crowd of being, you know, I always think of it, and, you know, I hope it never happens, but if we experience World War III right now, it's like, I want to be in a position that I can offer some, you know, I can look after the people around me and look after my family and look after, you know, the people in my town and the village and the country, kind of thing. I always want to be that person that would be able to go, do you know what? I'm 40 years old, even though I'm 39. But if we got into World War III, it wouldn't be just yet. So I might be 40, but I'm 40 years old. I'll go and do that.
Yeah. Mm, interesting. Interesting. And tell me about the challenges you got coming up this year then. Why, you know, is that part of, when you say plans, literally like Lucy's, it's in your mind, but do you have a plan? Like, this is what, you know, the next stage of my life looks like. You're saying come up to 40. It's a bit of one of those barriers in your mind. Not a barrier, you know, a marker in your life. Is there 3-year, 5-year, 10-year plan, or are you much more?
Yeah, I'm probably a bit more freestyle.
That's the phrase.
Yeah, I wish I could plan, but when I've tried to do it in the past, it just all goes completely wrong. Or I don't get there, or I lose the piece of paper, or I lose the lose the file on my computer. I think mentally inside there's, you know, things that I want to tick off. There's a definite direction and a path that I want to take, you know, whether that path changes along the way, that's a different thing. You know, this year's very different. I've got a lot of expeditions lined up. I've just had, you know, just filmed the TV show, which is brilliant, and leaving next week to go out to Everest Base Camp to teach on a mountain course, and then hopefully get a third summit of Everest and a summit of a mountain called Lhotse, and then straight out to K2 to climb the second highest.
You haven't done that one before?
No.
Okay.
That's in Pakistan.
Yeah.
And then there's some smaller mountains, so just guiding on those, and then out to Antarctica at the end of the year to guide on South Pole and Mount Vincent, which, so...
Amazing, amazing.
And I guess, you know, the rest of it in my very loose plan in my head is just trying to make sure that I'm still building a, you know, a life around that, and still building career paths. And, you know, if I want to, you know, not do any guiding in the next, you know, if I want to stop guiding in 5 years, then I still have things that I've got when I come out of that.
And how important is that for you to have that, like the other bits around that you could potentially?
Yeah, very important. I think, you know, just trying to spin as many plates as possible, and and that's how it keeps it exciting as well, right? I don't think I could ever just commit myself to one thing and just do that.
I was
going to
ask you that. Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. And I find it very admirable that people do that. You know, they commit their whole life to, I always find athletics bizarre, because it's, you know, someone commits their whole life to running 100 meters as fast as they can, and it's phenomenal.
Yeah.
And I enjoy watching it, but it's a crazy thing to
imagine training for that every day.
Yeah.
Just
get up. What are you going to do?
Yeah.
Run 100 meters.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I do like variety. I like having a lot of stuff going on. You know, like you said, I like learning new things and experiencing new things. And I just have a good anxiety where I kind of don't want to get to my deathbed and just go, oh, I wanted to do that and I never did it.
Yeah.
Or experience that and I never experienced it.
Yeah.
That's, and I think that might have been, you know, a part of the past and being exposed to, you know, conflict and war and that kind of stuff. I think you get a different appreciation for life.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. I re-released a podcast episode last week from a guy called Jamal Easel, who I met when I was at Virgin Startup, like Richard Branson's not-for-profit business. And he started with like £25,000. Well, he was in the city, you know, earning ridiculous amounts of money. And he ended up on a bus journey. American sat next to him. His American said, you know, what do you do? He told him. And he was just like, have you ever heard of the rocking chair test? And he was like, no. He's like, when you're in your rocking chair, you're at the end of your life, when you look back on your life, would you be happy with the impact you've made? He was just like that. I literally sat bolt upright on this 12-hour journey through Cambodia, Vietnam, wherever it was, going, no, I'm not fucking happy. I've done absolutely nothing. He's earned shit loads of money and throw it down my throat. So he goes, at that point in time, he decided, this is what I want to do. I want to help homeless people. So he created this business called Change Please, which is retraining homeless people as baristas. Wow. Giving them a living wage, a roof over their heads, yeah. Counselling, a checkbook, or a bank account, I should say, not a checkbook these days. And Richard flew him out to Necker Island for a mentoring session. And, you know, I introduced him to Virgin Atlantic. He gets his coffee on the plane, coffee on the trains, now opening up all over the place. But you're just like that. God, you make me feel so frigging inadequate, you know, but listening to someone's story like that. Yeah. But, you know, when you said that, it just kind of reminded me of that, you know, not having those regrets. You know, what do you think, you know, when you think back to maybe you as an 18-year-old, 19-year-old joining the army, those kind of infinite possibilities, and now looking back going, you've actually done this, this, and this, and you're about to embark on this crazy, for most people crazy, but kind of boy's own stuff, six, 7 months. Well, you know, what would your 18-year-old self would have thought of that? That's the reaction. There you go.
I don't know, you know, like he'd probably just say, I don't know. It is bizarre. Like I would have never thought, you know, being that 18, 19-year-old lad that's what you'd be doing when you're 39. I'd have no idea, like, that would be it. I don't know. It's hard to say because, you know, if you went back when I was 18, 19 years old, I was a little scrote. Do you know what I mean?
That's a great word, scrote.
I was a little chav from Preston. I had a skinhead. And tribal tattoos on my arm. I just wanted to get big in the gym and
right.
Drink at the weekend. So yeah, I think
very different. Very different.
Yeah, I mean it's a hard one to answer. I don't know. I've just always, I think deep down, even you know, when I was an 18-year-old scrote in Preston, I've always had a desire to have a different life and not kind of follow the status quo.
Certainly done that.
Yeah, and I think, you know, even when I was younger, I was big into fitness, big into running and lifting weights or whatever it was. And I joke that I was a scrote, but I was, you know, probably a scrote with potential. and, you know, I equally think joining the military and leaving my hometown and being exposed to different people and different cultures and people from different countries and going to different countries, it's an education in itself.
Big old world out there, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's, you know, being that 4 years in the paras was probably more educational than whatever it is you spend at school, 6, 7, 8 years, whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah. What scares you or are you fearful of that you'd look to overcome or have overcome maybe even? Wasn't a fear of heights, clearly.
No, like nothing physical. It's nothing really physical that scares me, like heights or anything like that, spiders. I'd say probably, I always feel like I hold myself back and that's something that I definitely want to overcome. And I've always felt like I've held myself back a bit too much. It might not seem it with what I do and the work that I do, but there's still a lot of things that I want to have in my life or I want to achieve or I want to do. And I find that I stall on those things and pull myself back.
Procrastinate
over, or, you know, I don't know it's not a fear of failure thing. It's probably a fear of not being worthy enough to do what I think I can do or what I want to do. And probably a fear of what other people would think of me if I did that.
Yeah.
So yeah, I still get held back by those kind of things.
And everybody does, don't they? Yeah. At some point. But and the only thing I think, one of the few things I've learned is that, you know, when you do feel fearful or anxious or something, and I only learned that by doing this like 75 hard thing and then doing the marathon on my own, is just like when you feel that fear and you push through it, and you'll know this yourself, obviously, but it's then when you grow and you're just like, why the hell did I waste 6 months thinking about that then?
Yeah.
Well, it's not like you go, that was easy, but you're like, that was frigging hard, but I can do anything now.
And it's like that whole thing that, we're so like we become so focused on what other people think of us, but actually everyone's just thinking about what, like everyone's so self-absorbed in their own life, aren't they? Absolutely. No one's going like, oh, I can't believe what he's doing.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean? He decided to do that. They're just going, what am I doing? Like, what am I wearing today? Like, where am I going today? Like, what? Like, I wish I never had this job. I wish I never had this relationship.
Yeah,
it is that, and you know, I fall victim to it just like everyone else does, I think.
I look to finish up, last couple of questions would be, so you moved to my neck of the woods, Dorset, not that long ago. See yourself putting any roots down there?
Yeah, I'd love to. I find it hard to settle anywhere.
I was going to ask you that. Okay, yeah. Do you?
Yeah. And I like to, you know, I've already got thoughts in my head of maybe taking a trip to Portugal for 12 months, basing myself out of there.
Okay. Do you like surfing?
And do you know what? The weather.
The weather, Alex.
The weather for me, winter weather this Christmas was just...
It's been like the longest, feels like, doesn't it? The longest winter we've ever had in the UK.
It's killed me.
I get it.
I think if I ever came, or, you know, I'm not saying that I'm definitely leaving, but I think out of everywhere in the UK, I'd definitely be in Dorset. I don't think I'd move out of Dorset.
Yeah. It's a great county.
It's beautiful.
Yeah. No, I love it. I moved down 20 years ago. I met my, living in London, met my girlfriend now, wife, mother of my children. Yeah. It's like, I wouldn't want to be anywhere.
Nah.
Just anywhere else.
I always want to live near the sea.
Yeah.
I don't think I could live anywhere else.
I'm the same. Would you live in the mountains?
Nah, I think I enjoy the sea, yeah. I enjoy the sea more than the mountains. I'd rather live on the sea and then travel to the mountains for work or whatever, as opposed to the other way around.
Interesting.
I feel like there's more to do in the sea.
Yeah.
There's more, you know, the mountains, there's a lot to do, but I feel just being in the sea, whether it's surfing or going for a cold dip or just walking on the beach, it's good. It's therapeutic.
It's very
It's good for your health.
Funnily enough, that's just reminded me, I was in a meeting at Bournemouth Airport last week with these guys who have it's called West Peak Performance. So, you know, helping CEOs, sportsmen and women better perform in what they do. We're making a podcast for them through a podcast agency. And they were talking about guests they wanted to have on. And, you know, some of your colleagues, yourself, your name came up. And I said, I'm in chatting to you next week for the podcast. And they were like, I'm sure I saw him spearfishing down in Southbourne last week. It's like, yeah, he lives down here. I don't know if he spearfishes, but that very well could have been him. Was it you?
Not recently, was it?
No, like recently.
Oh, like
no,
last like, summer.
Yeah.
Definitely me. Yeah.
Oh, okay. There you go.
I think someone called the police on us, actually. Because spear guns are obviously big guns with a spear on, but there's no law about being like in a street or on a beach with a spear gun. You don't have to have a license for it.
Right, okay.
And two of us had walked down to the beach.
You said you were with someone else.
Yeah, you get in the water and you obviously load the spear gun, like stick the rubber on so it's good to go. But yeah, a friend's girlfriend works for the police, you know, in the call centers.
Right.
And she was like, did you go spearing at this day? I was like, yeah, about this time. Yeah. She's like, we had a call come through from someone on the beach saying that there's two guys with guns on the beach. Yeah.
Oh, amazing. And look, finish up. People want to find out about climbing with you or find out more about you. Mm-hmm. Easiest place to go to your own website or
social media? My website, jmortonofficial.com, or Instagram is probably where I'm most active. Any climbing, Elite Exped. If you're interested in climbing with us, it's eliteexped.com or info@eliteexped.com, email.
And that's with Nims.
Yeah, so Nims has his clients. Mingma has some clients, and then you've got you need the climbing with Nims, which, you know, he's smashing it there, or myself, or a few of his other guides. So if you're looking at getting into high altitude mountaineering, then the mountain course that I'm about to run is definitely for you. Also something like Kilimanjaro, Aconcagua, they're good beginner mountains. Or if you want something hardcore, Everest or K2.
Amazing. Jay Morton, thank you very much.
If you've enjoyed listening to this episode, can I encourage you to follow the show by clicking the plus button in the top right-hand corner of your screen if you're listening via Apple Podcasts, or the follow button on Spotify and other platforms. It means you'll be the first to be notified whenever a new episode goes live. Did you know that nearly half of podcast listeners find a show through searching online? So if you've gotten any value at all, please share this episode with one or more of your friends and make it easy for them to find a podcast you think they'll enjoy. If you'd like to join the Screw It, Just Do It community, go to podpreneur.co.uk/get in touch, sign up to our weekly newsletter and free resources. That's podpreneur.co.uk/get-in-touch. touch. That's podpreneur.co.uk/get-in-touch.